So, thanks for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to speak in your journal club. I would have loved to come in person, but unfortunately, the situation doesn't allow, hopefully in the future. So today, this discussion is going to be mostly about this work with Sébastien Renaud-Pétel that we recently posted on archive. It is about the application of cosmological bootstrap, the recent tools that were developed over the past few years to setups in which we have heavy degrees of freedom during inflation, and we want to know what are the imprints of those degrees of freedom on primordial correlators. So I want to divide my discussion into two chunks. So in the first part, I would focus on the phenomenology, what is the relevance of this problem, especially for observation. And in the second part, I'm going through the theory and say that what is this new frontier in our theoretical understanding of the structure of cosmological correlators, and finally, a few words of conclusions. So starting from cosmological collider physics, so let's start with the simple fact that this current observation of Planck still allows for the simplest possible models for inflation. You can have a canonical scalar field that is rolling on almost a flat potential, and there is no problem with it as far as our observation is concerned. And then these setups can derive a background for you that is close to the Sitter space. You can chart it with the conformal coordinate or with T and X if you want. And then the phenomenology is a bit bleak in this situation because the setup doesn't allow large FNL, large non-Gaussianity. In fact, there is a theorem that proves if you are very close to the Sitter isometries, or the Sitter isometries is exact, then the theory has to be free, so there should be no interaction at all. Although in reality, always you have some level of interaction, so you have this gravitational floor, which tells you that the FNL cannot be lower than something like 10 to the minus 2, the Storer parameters, due to the mixing with gravity. So by the way, because there are a few of us, please feel free to tune in. I don't have any ambition to get to the last slide as far as we are discussing something useful.
How are you?
Good. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm good.
Good. Is there a question? Okay, maybe it's just microphone bug. So one obvious way to enrich the phenomenology would be to just add a new degrees of freedom, just go beyond the single field setup. And in fact, that is very natural point of view in the sense that we have all these standard model fields around us. So certainly our universe is not single field. And you can ask, what were these fields doing during inflation? Of course, the usual rhetoric is that these fields were irrelevant, their energy density, they were not storing any significant part of energy density of the universe, and they did not have a huge interaction with inflaton to change our prediction, so they are negligible. But in fact, if you have setups in which you have actually new degrees of freedom, that their mass is not far from the Hubble scale, it's not much higher than the Hubble scale, you expect that if they have sizable couplings to the inflaton fluctuations, their effect, the impact can be seen in the primordial correlation functions. So this is the famous idea of cosmological collider physics. There has been many works since the time that people started to compute on Gaussianity. There were always this back in the mind of the theorists from the quasi-single field back in 2009, and then more recently by Arkani, Hamed, and Maldacena. So here the idea is that the scale of the, sorry, I don't have the cursor, and I don't know how to enable it, so I just try to move my hands. Sorry about that. So here we have the idea is that the energy scale of inflation, the Hubble, can be just as high as 10 to the 14 GeV, And this is like not accessible with any conceivable tertiary collider, particle collider. Therefore, it's an opportunity for probing particle physics beyond the standard model as well. So the simplest setup in which you add new degrees of freedom to inflation is the situation in which you respect the Sitar isometries, meaning that in the decoupling limit, when you don't have the metric, you just start to write down Lorentz invariant interaction between your scalar field and, let's say, a new scalar with mass m. And then, of course, you can once you minimally couple this theory to gravity, you have the full the Sitar isometries. You better also respect the shift symmetry of inflation. So you can add, for instance, this dimension 5 operator, where you could have higher derivative terms. And these sort of interactions are going to, even if the self-interactions of inflaton are small, these interactions can effectively give you non-negligible three-point functions for phi. This works because if you expand around the if you weakly bracketed the Sitar isometries by switching on a background for phi, which is the situation in a slow roll, for instance, phi equals phi bar dot times t plus perturbation delta phi, then if you expand this, you get like a quadratic mixing between phi and sigma, cubic mixing, and other terms. For instance, for these two particular well-motivated interactions, through these types of single exchange diagrams, you can generate three-point function for perturbation. You would love to work with, instead of delta phi, you would like to work with the gauge invariant quantity in cosmology, which is the curvature perturbation, zeta. And then we can talk about the three-point function zeta and the non-Gaussian shape of zeta, which is defined by this formula. Basically, this S is like the dimensionless part of the three-point function. The scaling with k, 1 over k to the 6, is just factored out. And then we can like compute this and then plot the shape of the non-Gaussian. Let's say I have a triangle like this. There should be a triangle for three-point function because of the conservation of momentum. Let's say it's an isosceles triangle. For simplicity, you have two short modes and a long mode. And then you basically just draw the shape as a function of the ratio between the long mode and the short mode. So what happens is that in this Sitar invariant collider case, starting from the equilateral, you see a bump, and then the shape decreases. And then when you get to the squeeze limit, when the triangle is very squeezed, you start to see some oscillations. So there is a meaning attached to these both situations. The first part, that the shape almost looks like the template that cosmologists tend to call equilateral or orthogonal, and then the usual oscillations that they encode the quantum oscillation of the massive field. So in the first part, on the right side, close to equilateral, so the signal can be reproduced effectively by an effective field theory. So basically, close to equilateral shape, you can, if the mass of the particle is much heavier than Hubble, you expect that you can integrate out this field. And then in terms of, instead of this exchange diagram, you basically substitute them with local terms that come from integrating out the field. And then the coefficients of the operators are going to be suppressed by inverse powers of the mass, just from the rational, EFT rational. And then if you, with these contact terms, actually the computation is very simple. You have like a delta phi is almost massless. You have a background, the Sitar, the mode functions are super simple. If you just compute, you will see, you just find almost the same signal, almost not exactly.
So why is it correct to integrate out the field? Because, well, the mass is over the Hubble, and we're looking at scales shorter than Hubble.
No, I'm assuming that it is bigger than Hubble. Let's say it is twice, three times bigger than Hubble.
All right, you have it here.
And then you have a systematic expansion.
I see.
Yes, so this is the rationale of EFT. Of course, it is not exact. So in particle physics, if I had like this theory, and then the center of mass energy was Hubble, and the mass was bigger than Hubble, this would work. But in cosmology, of course, this you have the particle creation effect, which tells you that no matter how big the mass is, you always have some, you make some error with this point of view, because you cannot, this is non-perturbative effect in 1/m. So there is no way that you can capture the percreation effect with your EFT. So this particle creation, as I said, is exponentially small. And also it features the oscillations in K long over K short. And these oscillations encode the quantum oscillations of the mode function, basically when the mode associated with the fluctuations of the massive field, when it exits the horizon, it starts to oscillate like e to the imt. Of course, there is a decay, which is reflected in the K long over K short to the 3/12, due to the decay of the number density of the particles. And then the oscillations is the quantumness of these particles. Of course, if you also have a spin, there is an interesting signal that tells you that depending on how you approach the squeeze limit, there is an angle. Then there is an angle dependence that encodes the spin through a Legendre polynomial. So this is the basic cosmological collider signal due to the single exchange diagrams. And its pitfall is that either you are in the EFT regime, where things are suppressed by 1/mass to some power, or in the squeeze limit regime, where things are oscillating, but you are exponentially small. You have exponentially small signal. Now I'm going to argue that if you relax a little bit, strongly, the de Sitter isometries, in the sense that you just break the de Sitter isometries from the get-go by introducing a speed of sound for your fluctuations, the situation potentially can be much more, much richer. In the sense that, yeah, first of all, let's assume that, let's fix a framework. So usually actually inflation doesn't have to be a canonical scalar field. If you have this framework of a beautiful framework of single field EFT of inflation, in which you actually drop the fact that you're writing a theory around vacuum, you don't have to. So inflation is more like condensed matter rather than particle physics. So you just look at your symmetry breaking. So you say that inflation breaks the time foliation of a space time. So you have a preferred time foliation. And then you characterize your fluctuations as the Goldstone of this broken symmetry. So the diffeomorphisms in time can be nonlinearly realized by a Goldstone, which we call pi. And of course, the curvature perturbation that is going to be relevant for observation is related to pi up to leading order in a slow roll by this relation. And then you start to write down the invariant building block. I won't go through the details, but the upshot is that you get something that should be allowed to have a speed of sound. And observationally, we know that this speed of sound cannot be too small. It can still be small, like bigger than 10 to the minus 2. Because if you have a smaller speed of sound, necessarily you also have some interaction, cubic interactions, because of the nonlinearly realized diffeomorphisms, which are of this type, pi prime, nabla pi squared. You could also have other interactions as well. Then once you have this single field description, you can start, nothing stops you from extending this framework to multi-field. This was a work, I'm not including all the references here, apologies. There was a paper by Senatore and Zaldarriaga maybe about a decade ago, the EFT of multi-field. You can add additional fields. Like, let's say, again, I have a massive field. For simplicity, I assume that is relativistic. It has a unit sound speed. And then you can add the lowest order derivative operators that mix pi and sigma. In particular, just very similar to the previous case, let's say cubic interactions and linear mixings, like with time derivatives or special derivatives. The bottom line here, the difference here is that the time and space just separate out because you don't have a boost symmetry. So once you have this types of single exchange, you can start to compute what we had computed before. But even before that, just by looking at the
question, why does sigma have the same have a speed of sound of one? Shouldn't that also generally have a different speed?
Yeah, you can. It could have a general speed, but then you can always have the liberty to rescale your coordinates in such a way that you set to one of the speeds, and then
you're ignoring gravitational waves here, I guess.
I mean the decoupling limit. Yeah. Yes, okay. Of course, in the decoupling limit where, I hope that with this, get the largest part of the signal. Yeah, of course, there are gravitational corrections.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any other question about the setup? Okay, good. So now, even before doing any computation, having a speed of sound, you can smell that the situation is different due to the following observation. So let's say I have the spectrum of different scales, let's say in momentum space, the physical momentum K over the scale factor. And then let's go from UV to the IR. So in the UV, you have Planck scale, quantum gravity, don't know anything about it. Actually, even before that, the EFT stopped to work. Because of the self-interactions of pi, they become strongly coupled at this momentum scale. And then you have the sound horizon crossing when the modes cross the sound horizon and they freeze. So this happens actually at momentum Hubble over CS. In the usual case, it is just Hubble. And then you have the curvature scale of the space-time, which is Hubble. So now the situation is different when you have the speed of sound, because if you didn't have the speed of sound, there would be no difference between the sound horizon and the curvature scale. Now, there is a window here. And when the mass of the particle is in this window, which actually can be a huge window, so CS can be still as small as 10 to the minus 2. So this could be 100 times Hubble. So if the mass lies in this in this part of the spectrum, then you can actually, even though the sigma is very heavy, compared to the curvature scale, you cannot integrate it out in a local fashion. The reason is that when the relevant scale for the pi fluctuation, if you want, is the sun horizon crossing. So when it is crossing the sun horizon, the sigma field is still relativistic because its momentum is comparable to its mass. Therefore, when it is relativistic, there is no sense in which you can integrate it out. You have to keep it in your spectrum. So this is an unprecedented situation, because if the speed of sound is one, then there is no region of this type. Therefore, when the mass is in this region, you expect that your signal cannot be suppressed by 1/m², right? Because that is just the rationale behind the EFT. And you say that here, even if it is parametrically heavier than Hubble. So this is something that I think is very interesting. And then we have to see when you do the actual computation, what comes out of it. And notice that this Hubble over CS can be big. So if there is interesting effects, it means that this low speed collider is going to be very UV sensitive, in the sense that if Hubble is 10 to the 14 GeV, then this can be even parametrically larger than 10 to the 14 GeV. And anyway, so you expect the case to go to the usual, to morph to the usual situation when you increase the mass beyond Hubble over CS, because then when the modes cross the sound horizon, I go back to the usual case that the massive field is non-relativistic, and then you can integrate it out. Now, let's assume that with the method that I'm going to explain, I compute the three-point function, the exchange diagram, and the shape, depending on the vertices, more or less looks like this graph. So what happens here is that the situation dramatically changes. So previously, remember that the graph would just start from the equilateral shape and come down. So you get like an equilateral Lagrangianity. But here, you actually goes up.
I don't think I quite got the scales, and the argument why you cannot integrate out the field. Yeah, can you explain a bit more that?
Yes. So if you want, I can. So it's a PT that I cannot write, I try to explain in words. So let's forget
about. You could use whiteboard if you want. Just click on the whiteboard. You could annotate as well if you want. yeah, on the slide.
Yeah, let's say. Sorry, I usually tend to work with the PowerPoint, but
no, just Zoom has an annotate feature. If you just if you're sharing a screen, there's an annotate. This like has a pen or something different.
Really? I didn't know about this. So let me see. I think that I have to stop share or not.
No, just on the on what you're sharing, you could use this, I think.
Sorry, I cannot find it now. Let's look. It's simple. So let's just forget about cosmology. Let's say I'm doing a 2 to 2. So let's say this sigma field is just coupled to pi with these interactions. Let's consider the interaction in the middle. So it's a cubic vertex between sigma and pi. And then let's assume I'm computing a 2 to 2 scattering of pi. So 2 pi's goes to 2 pi. So the answer is just going to be proportional to 1 over the propagator, but the propagator is what? So it is CS times the momentum P1 plus P2 minus the momentum P1 plus P2 squared minus M squared. So all I'm saying here is that when the usual situation is that if the CS was not there, you would say that when the energy is much bigger than mass, then you can just bring the energy and momentum to the numerator and you expand, you get an expansion 1 over n. So that is the EFD, just at 3 level. So here, what I'm saying is that there is a situation in which the energy is less than m, but it's still the gradient term are not negligible with respect to mass. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you can, so the time derivatives, you can expand them, but the special derivatives are comparable to mass, so you cannot do. So this is the situation I'm calling. So there is a sense in which you can integrate it out, but not in the usual fashion. So it's going to give you non-local term in the space. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense because you have like, there is this mediating particle that is moving very fast. So if you want, it's a bit like the binaries in which like gravitationally, they just move much slower than the speed of light. But then you can effectively integrate out graviton and then consider it as a action at a distance. So this is like a,
Yes, I see.
The sense that, yeah, if you want, yeah, probably this was confusing. You can integrate it out, but in a non-local way.
Yes.
That is exactly, you can actually write down the Lagrangian and the non-local Lagrangian and compute it, and it's going to reproduce this shape in the EFT part as well. So it's going to be, that's why I call it non-local EFT. So what happens is that the plot goes up and then you go on a resonance and then you start the particle production signal. And this resonance is, happens at the characteristic ratio between long and short, and it is the smoking gun of having supersonic massive particles, if you want. And the size of the signal, it is more interesting in the sense that if you compute it that equilateral, the size of the signal is going to logarithmically run with time. So instead of power 1 over some power law or the exponential, the Boltzmann suppression, it goes like a power law. Of course, in the super squeeze limit, you go back to the because the description is that your pair creation should be exponentially small, so that will be reached. But in the intermediate regime, which I call it moderately squeezed, you have this this resonance. So this is the phenomenology. This is the what I think is new. And so, by the way, this graph is not numeric. There is an analytic formula for this graph, and I'm going to explain how you can find this thing. So this is a story of. So if there is any question about the first part,
can you go back to this plot? So I want to understand. You said there's a characteristic scale. So the value of it is this CS over times M over H. Is that the scale?
Yeah, so I'm assuming that M over H is less than 1 over CS, so that this number is less than 1. Otherwise, it wouldn't make any sense. Because if you increase M over M beyond H over CS, then it morphs to the usual case. So it comes out down, and then you have equilateral goes to squeeze. Because that is the situation where you can locally integrate out sigma.
Mm-hmm. So M is bigger than, CS is... like if CS is 10 to the minus 2, you said M is 100 times bigger than H, or
it should be lighter than 100 times bigger than
H. Lighter than 100 times. Okay, very good. Thank you.
Yeah. Any other question about this plot? And so I'm gearing to.
I had a quick question.
Yeah.
I was curious if you had thought, you know, you're strongly breaking Disiter invariance. So
yes.
Have you thought about, you know, how these results depend on assumptions about your initial conditions? I mean, like just for example, you know, the assumption of the universe beginning flat or open probably could lead to some pretty dramatic differences because of the way that, you know, you're explicitly breaking this Disiter invariance.
Oh yeah, so that's a very good question. That I really don't have any idea. I think that is in general a question for EFT for inflation. Like, how can you actually realize these models in regarding initial condition, or if you want, whether there is a viable UV completion for this. So I was not looking at it. So I was just content with the low energy effective field. Yeah, I assume that there is a sensible initial condition, you can have inflation, and then these are like EFT for your perturbations. So that was basically the rationale. But I don't know. So
but
I think that you can ask this question in the context of like if you have something like DBI, whether mm-hmm. what happens to the initial condition. I think that that's a well-posed question, but I don't know really.
I mean, even at the level of the perturbations, you would also. I mean, you know. Forget about the background, but even just at the level of the perturbations given that assumption, I imagine you could find some pretty different results.
So why is that? I mean, you mentioned curvature. Let's assume that the curvature was like inflation lasts much longer than 60 folds. Should I be worried about?
Well, I don't know, like in an open universe, there are some, you know, there are new modes associated with the curvature scale.
Yes.
Or you know, okay. Eigenvalues of the Laplacian on the spatial hypersurfaces that, you know, have, you can get these bound states and so on and so forth. So,
there is a story about that. Actually, we had a paper with Enrico about this. It was called the curvature that sound horizon. So there is an interplay if you want. So because when you have a speed of sound, actually potentially you can be more sensitive to the curvature scale because the mode frees much earlier than Hubble crossing. So it could be the time in which omega k is not completely diluted. So I don't know if that is related, but I just wanted to mention that.
I think it is. Yes. Thanks. Yeah, no, just curious.
Yes. I don't know. So I think that it is super complicated to do so even the it is not clear that the formalism is the completely established doing perturbation theory in open universe. Problems about the initial condition, the vacuum, whether how you should define your adiabatic vacuum. Yeah, there are things that I don't really know and understand. Thanks a lot, Matthew, for the question.
Yeah, thank you.
So in the second part, hopefully not very long. So I just outline how we go about solving analytically this question. So this is about the cosmological bootstrap picture. So I have put some fancy pictures here just to say that what is the philosophy? So the philosophy is that if I compute this four-point function, do some prediction for CMB, how do I know that whether this is consistent? So I just use the Lagrangian that was local. If I hand you a four-point function, how do you know that it's consistent? Like, I mean, in the scattering amplitude, there are rules that it should satisfy. I mean, if it's a three-level four-point function, a two-to-two scattering, I mean, it should have like simple poles. I mean, on the residue of the pole, the four-point amplitude should factorize in the product of three-point amplitude and things like that. So it is not, we don't have the same sophisticated understanding of amplitudes for correlated. So that is the idea. So the left-hand side is the situation is similar to someone that is painting a three-dimensional building. So if you look at the two-dimensional picture, you can say whether it corresponds to a three-dimensional consistent building or not. So you can ask the question for a space-time. If you look at the map of CMB, can you say that it comes from a consistent theory in the bulk of a space-time or not? So after this fancy story, let's go to the real world. So let's say I'm just a very humble cosmologist, and I just want to compute the single exchange diagram. So in perturbation theory, what we do? You have this Feynman graph. For it has two vertices. You have bulk to boundary propagator. You have some vertex factors. It can have derivative operators. And for internal lines, you have bulk to bulk propagators. I think that most of you are familiar with this definitions. So nothing fancy. So you just give this to Mathematica. And then in the internal line, you have massive mode functions, like they are Hankel nonlinear functions. You give it to Mathematica, it's just going to give you, it's just going to stare at you. So it do nothing. So this is like a bit of a shameful experience in the sense that, so let's say in particle physics, the 2-2-2 scattering that was exemplifying to Sergei. So this is like the first thing that you do in a QFT course. You just write down the scattering amplitude for 2-2-2 scattering. So this question analytically was not answered for the Sitter invariant collider, just the CS equal one, until 2018. So there were no closed answer to a three-level single exchange diagram for a four-point function in the Sitter space. So this is like sketches the severity of the complexity of the problem. And that paper actually didn't take the integral. It used the bootstrap. It introduced the bootstrap approach. But there are good things about in formalism. So the process is that you start from a Hamiltonian that is Hermitian. So you know that you're not computing something that has ghosts. So everything is explicitly unitary. The couplings are real and everything. And you know that your theory is local. You have the AA dagger, cluster decompositions, everything, so that you don't introduce one over Laplacians. The theory is local. And then if you have symmetries, like they are manifest. So these things are manifest in the informalism. They are very good in this sense. But at the same time, they are obscuring the simplicity of the final answer, pretty much like in a scattering amplitude. So you have Feynman rules. The perturbation theory. It is good, you know, that the final answer has to have these properties, but the path to the answer is going to be very long, whereas the final answer has the simplicity that this formulation is obscuring. I don't go through.
My ask here. So, yeah, when you have this connection with amplitudes and kind of complexity of Feynman rules and simplicity of final answer, that's usually for gauge theories and gravity, yeah, because basically the Feynman Feynman rules formalism does not capture those very well.
So for amplitude, that's true. For amplitude, for scalars, there isn't much that the Anschel methods, but for cosmology, actually, the situation, because you don't have time translation symmetry, you actually see it more vividly even at the scalar theory. So for scalars, you see that when you do the in computation, the different terms that you get, you get a bunch of terms that every one of these has wrong singularities. Like it has singularities in locations that shouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. And then when you add them up, you see that they all cancel. Mm-hmm. So there are like miraculous cancellations already for three-level computations that you don't see it with the mean.
Yes. So what properties are not captured? Yeah. So that's perhaps my question here. Really.
Yeah. So the properties that are not captured, like even for the scalar theories, there's still this redundancy as well, right? I mean, you can have like field definitions too. You can have field definitions that vanish on the boundary. Mm-hmm. And there are many operators that just predict the same correlator on the boundary. Mm-hmm. You can just change your definition of zeta and gamma. So this is actually the situation. So this is actually a situation for EFT for inflation. So you get a lot of operators, but then you can just switch many of them, switch off many of them by just doing some transformation of the field. Whereas if you do it on shell, just on the boundary, you don't see it because it just pops out if you just write down the correct ansatz in one go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but about the properties, yes, I mean, there will be some analyticity property. There will be something about the, so if you want unitarity, for example, at the level of the, let's say I'm computing a wave function of the universe. I start with an Hamiltonian. I know that I'm computing something that is, that respects unitarity. But then it is very obscure that the level of the final answer, if you just give me the final answer, it's not clear that what properties is associated with unitarity. Mm-hmm. So that is the question, type of question that I want to answer, that if I know that the coupling was real, then how the integration over time preserve this information? Right, so these sort of things that we would like to. I don't know how much time do I have. Although,
well, until roughly one, we're shooting for. So about 20 minutes.
Oh, 20 minutes. Okay, great. Yeah. So is it okay, Sergey? If I go on, so
we can, yeah. You go ahead. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, we can discuss it at the end. If there was something that wasn't clear about the philosophy, just please tell me, then we can discuss it through. So now, what do we want to replace it? So we want to take, we want to complement this in informalism that we have and we love, and find something instead of like chasing the dynamics in time, just do a labor work of like doing this computation. If we want to like find some boundary rules, as I said, that are derived from the physical principles. Like, oh, look, you know that in the box you have locality, unitarity. There are some, at least for tree level, you know that there are some poles that should not be allowed. So some analyticity properties, just for tree level. I mean, I will not be ashamed of like looking at the time integrals to see that some poles should not be allowed. And also symmetries, I mean, and this should translate into some boundary rules. So just to make one more example, even at the level of symmetries, I think it's very beautiful result. So in terms of Lagrangian, if you want to know what are the predictions for three-point function of gamma, so whether or not observers are going to actually measure the three-point functions, I think it is very futuristic, but you could ask if I have a de Sitter background and if my theory is GR or if it is not GR, if it is anything, you could have higher derivative corrections to GR. What is the three-point function? So answer in scattering amplitude is very simple, right? The three-point function is just completely non-perturbatively fixed by Lorentz invariance. So the same is also true for cosmology. So you can solve a Ward identity because of the conformal symmetry of the de Sitter on the boundary. And there are only two templates that you get for three-point function of gravitons. This was a beautiful remark by Malacena and Pimentel. I don't know, it goes back to maybe 15 years ago. And the answer is just going to be Ricci and Wall cube. So these are the two on the operators. So the rest of the operators, to any order in derivatives are going to be a linear combination of these two shapes. So this is just one example, just only symmetries, nothing else really, are so constraining. So now I want to just go through this a bit more detail of the computation. So now with this general remarks, that how I compute my own with these beautiful words, how I'm going to compute this single exchange at the end, that is what I care about. So the first observation that is going to be useful, and it was also used in the 2018 paper by Arkani, Hamad and company, is the fact that you can, so usually you're allowed to have many vertices, many kinds of vertices, especially when you break boosts. But at the end, you can show that all these single exchange diagrams, no matter what vertex you put with how many derivatives, they can always be mapped onto a simpler object, a building block that actually has all the de Sitter isometries. So this is going to be the four-point function of a conformally coupled field in the Sitter that is exchanging the same massive field. And the interactions are super simple, just the simplest, is the relevant operator, phi squared sigma, etc. And then once you have this four-point, once you have bootstrap this four-point, then the rest, all the other three-point functions just comes out easily by applying a proper weight-shifting operator, because you go from conformally coupled field, its mass squared is 2h squared, to the massless field, our pi, the Goldilocks, which is massless. So there is a small important detail here. And that is the fact that I want the speed of sound, right? So you have the Sitter invariance. So the fact that you have broken boost appears in two aspects of this computation. One is that the weight shifting operators are not going to commute with the generators of boosts that you expect because you're breaking boost. The second thing is that you are just strongly breaking boost, not only at the level of interactions, strongly at the level of propagator. So because of that, actually this four-point function should be analytically continued beyond the physical scope, because you want to have the speed of sound. Therefore, I have to send the case. So let's say here, everything is in momentum space. So you have like K1, K2, K3, K4, all three-dimensional vectors. And then the external legs, their size, I want to rescale with the speed of sound. And at the same time, I don't want to change the momentum of the exchanging particle. So this is an extraordinary situation. The reason is that, actually, if you go about the details of the problem, you'll see that the four-point function, the seed four-point function can be written in terms of two. So this is very similar to the, I think in CFT, people call it the conformal ratios. The ratio between the energy of the mediating particle and the sum of the energies of the external particles. I'm using a bit of a bad terminology here because there is no energy in cosmology. It's not conserved. I just call the size of the three-dimensional vectors energy, because at the end, it is very similar to energy. So the four-point function only depends on these two ratios. So S is the intermediate momentum. K1 and K2 are the size of the momentum of the external legs. And then what I want is that I want to rescale K1, K2, K3 with the speed of sound. I want to send K4 to zero, because on the right-hand side, I should take a soft limit to go to the three-point function from a four-point function. And this means that these ratios U and V has to be actually bigger than one. They should be allowed to be bigger than one. Whereas in the de Sitter invariant case, when you have a speed of sound equal to one, just simply because of triangle inequality, the fact that S is like vector K1 plus vector K2, this ratio should be less than one. So that is the unusual situation with breaking boosts. So actually this four-point function was, as I said, was computed for the first time in 2018 by Arkani, Hamad and company, but it was only as a series that was converged inside the unit disk when U and V were less than one. And the story is just dramatically, it took us 1.5 years to just solve all the equations again from scratch for something, so for the four-point function outside this region, which is irrelevant if you have a de Sitter correlator because of just the conservation of momentum triangle inequality. But here, because you have the speed of sound, you have to laboriously find the analytical continuation beyond. And it is not easy to resum the series to find it. To find it obviously from the convergence series inside the unit disk. So there are several steps to this. Obviously, I don't want to bother you with all the details, but let's say, so usually the four-point function has four different parts in the ININ. You have plus plus, minus minus, plus minus minus plus components, which is because of the four types of bulk to bulk propagators that you have. But let's concentrate on the F plus plus part, because the rest are going to be easy. And the integral is given by this. So you have this e to the ik etas. These are because of the conformally coupled field. You have the massive field bulk to bulk propagator with this with these annoying Hankel functions as mode functions. And then you want to use locality and unitarity analyticity in order to pinpoint the final answer without actually taking the integral. So what are the steps? So the locality, so what does locality mean here is that you're computing a 4-point on the boundary, and this is induced by the exchange of some particle that is actually propagating inside space-time, and it follows a local equation of motion. So its bulk-to-bulk propagator, just the Feynman propagator, satisfies the in momentum space, satisfies this differential equation, which is local. So this is an equation in a space-time, but I don't want this. I want to turn this into an equation for a bound in terms of the boundary variables. So the 4-point functionality depends on this U and V, and then you can turn this equation. So how do I do this? I just cheat from the bulk time integral. I'm not ashamed of that. I can just look at the time integral, just manipulate it and turn this boundary, this bulk equation into a boundary equation for the point. And then this is possible, and it is very non-trivial that why this is possible, but it is possible. And you can see that the locality in the bulk translates into this local differential equation in terms of the boundary kinematics. So nothing here depends on time. So everything just depends on the external momentum. And on the left-hand side, you have a differential equation, second-order differential equation. Mu captures the mass. On the right-hand side, actually, you get a contact term. So it is as if this operator that acts on the 4-point function, it is as if it is integrating out this this massive field. It replaces it by a contact term at leading order. So at leading order, phi squared sigma, if you integrate that sigma, you get a phi to the 4. So on the right-hand side, you have a phi to the 4 term, 4-point as a source for this equation. So it is very hard to further speculate that what are like the most generic boundary equation that you get for a general correlator and what are the rules, that I don't know. So at least for this specific 4-point function, I can say that you can do this manipulation. So now this boundary equation, you want to solve it. And solving it is very non-trivial. You have to propose, the best you can do is to write a series expansion that is convergent in the region of our interest, which is outside the unit disk. And then there should be also a logarithm because of consistency. And then you get a series, you have to recursively solve it. It's a hard but algebraic problem, and you can do it. And then your problem is not fully solved because of course you can add homogeneous solutions. And the homogeneous solutions are just going to be the, you can explicitly see that they are the product, in general, they are the product of the 3-point function. So the constituent 3-point function, which are phi, phi, sigma. And they come in 4 different combinations. So you have 4 degrees of freedom that are not fixed by locality. So locality tells you the particular solution, but 4 degrees of freedom are still remaining. And now then comes the unitarity, which probably is the most interesting part. So recently, with Enrico and Harry, we discovered that what should unitarity mean for a perturbative computation for a 3-level correlator. So it comes from the fact that, so first of all, unitarity at 3-level, even in amplitude, it is nothing but the reality of the coupling and the certain property for the propagator, that the imaginary part of the Feynman propagator, 1 over ps squared minus ms squared, the imaginary part is just the delta function. So that is in flat space. So there is a similar, so if you want, in perturbation theory, Staeger s equal 1 is just equivalent to what I said. So now in cosmology, I don't know what is the analog of Staeger x equal 1. That would be the non-perturbative statement about unitarity. I don't have that. But in perturbation theory, I can see what I can, how far I can get. And it is the fact that the couplings are real, but then what are the propagators? So if you have a healthy theory, you don't have ghosts, you don't have a gradient instability, things go like e to the ik eta in the infinite past, then there are certain things that you can say about propagators. So for instance, the plus plus propagator has to have this property. So if you add g to g star, on the right-hand side, all the step functions that were annoying in anin, they just disappear. You get a factorized form, like the bulk-to-bulk goes to bulk-to-boundary propagator. And then you also have this Hermitian analyticity of the bulk-to-boundary propagator, which tells you that if you take the star of phi, it is as if you are sending k to minus k. That doesn't happen if you have the most function with e to the k eta. It was just exponentially exploding, but it happens for e to the ik eta just because of the Hermitian analyticity. So if you put all this together, they nicely translate into an algebraic property for the four-point function. It tells you that it gives you a factorization theory, very similar to the factorization of the amplitude. It tells you that if you add the four-point function to its star, and inside the star, you send u and v to minus u and minus v, then on the right-hand side, you get the product of three-point functions. So these three-point functions are given by this formula. It doesn't matter the details, but it's the analog of the factorization. Although there is a difference that there is no pole here that you have to go on to see that things factorize. It just happens globally for your kinematics. But the important thing that is built into this theorem is that you have to analytically continue. So u and v has to be positive for physical configurations, right? There is no sense in which u and v, they were just the ratio of the momentum, size of the momentum. So there is no sense in which they can be negative. So you have to analytically continue. Once you have done that, this should be the property. We call it cutting rules, and you can extend these cutting rules to arbitrary tree level. There was also work by Enrico and Scott Melville that they do it also for loops. There is a difference. So at loops, you get a statement like the sum of the cuts, all the possible cuts of a certain diagram should vanish, and its incarnation for tree level is this type of single cutting rule that I'm using here. So using this, you get like you kill 2 degrees of freedom out of the 4 that I was explaining, and the remaining 2 degrees of freedom are going to be killed by asking analyticity. So what is analyticity? Then again, for tree level computation and with the initial condition that is Bunch-Davis, knowing the fact that the free fields should go to e to the ik eta, not to a linear combination of e to the ik eta and e to the minus ik eta, which would be the situation with non-Bunch-Davis initial vacuum. For Bunch-Davis, you cannot have singularities in the physical domain. So if you take a four-point function, which form a quadrilateral, for instance, if you go on a diagonal, which means that in terms of u and v, is that like either you send u or v to 1, then things should be regular. There should not be any pole. So this is going to be extremely constraining. So it's going to just kill both degrees of freedom that appear. It's going to just fix everything. Of course, there are other poles, which we didn't have to use them. Other poles can emerge once you analytically continue in U. For instance, when you send the sum of the external energies to 0, this is called the total energy pole. The four-point function has a singularity, and the residue of the singularity is actually proportional to the scattering amplitude of the same process in flat space. Or you could have partial energy pole. When you sum the energies of at a single vertex, then the four-point function get a pole as well, similarly proportional to the three particle amplitude. And then you could also get branch cut due to particle production. So due to the oscillations that I was talking about in the beginning, you also have a branch cut. So these are the allowed singularities in three level. And then asking the absence of anything other than this will fix the full answer. And once you have this F, you can plot it, for instance, as a function of U. And then this plot will, using the weight shifting operator from left, from the four-point function, you just go to the plots of the shape of non-Gaussianity that I was telling you about. So finally, I would like to conclude. So I hope convince you that the cosmological bootstrap is useful. It gives you some tools to compute templates for non-Gaussianity, even if you are a pure observer or an analogist that doesn't care about theory. There is still there is a huge room for improvements on our computational power in cosmology using these bootstrap techniques. And in this work, I try to just exemplify this by looking at this a very simple setup in which you break boost and you have massive particles, and then it led to this identification of new signatures of supersonic heavy particles during inflation. And there are obvious future directions. So I didn't talk much about the size of the signal. So unfortunately, the size of this signal is bound because of unitarity, not the same unitarity as I was talking about, but the unitarity about this, about the size of the couplings. The FNL cannot be really bigger than one for this case. So if you want to have a have something that the people will have craving for, you have to consider multiple exchanges of massive fields, because those diagrams can actually have signals that are proportional to the to 1/√ of the power spectrum. So you could get enhancement by a factor of 100, but those are like much more complicated to compute analytically, although you could hope to do it numerically. Also, you could have had the spins. There was a parallel paper by Pimentel and Wang that they also include a spin, although they don't discuss the resonance. They just consider the squeeze limit. And there are other problems also in the on the theoretical frontier. I would like to understand this bootstrap better. Probably run some explore things like positivity for the correlators. I mean, how this bootstrap program can encode information about the UV. If I don't know yet about the UV, if I just do the computation in EFT, how the EFT correlators are related to the UV completion, things like that. So I hope this will lead to some interesting discussion in the future. And I'd be happy to answer any questions if there is.
All right, let's thank Sadra for a great talk. So there were a lot of questions during the talk. Are there, we have time for a few more, if there's any left.
Yeah, so yes. I think on the practical side, so yes, I understand that this bootstrap really helps to understand analytical properties. But just to compute the signal, yes. Is it simpler to take integrals? I mean, what is the, yeah.
Yeah, so the signal, the integral, it is impossible to. So, I mean, this sort of exchange diagrams have been on the table of people probably for the better part of 2 decades, I would say. Like this Quanzi single field, Chen, Yivong and company. And there has been always like numerics, but it was impossible. I don't know another way to. So probably if the fact that we can do it with this bootstrap technique maybe shows that we have been like a stupid. We didn't do the right change of variables for the integral. I don't know. But I just cannot answer this question because I don't know. It is infinite.
Yeah, no, I mean change of variable, not to take it analytically, but numerically. Is it so? Are there
No. Numerically, it is possible. Yeah, of course. Yeah, numerically, you can actually compute numerically. No, it is. But usually, with observation, we want the template for a fair range of parameter, right?
Right.
And here you have 2 parameters, CS and M over H, so it's a bit expensive to.
So the challenge with doing it numerically is that these are highly oscillatory functions, and then you multiply them, and I mean, if you don't do it right, then there's oscillations.
Right, no, I understand, yes. But in principle, these are Hankel functions, so people know how to do these Bessel integrals with Bessel functions,
But I mean, there is a bit, for contact terms, I agree with Niyash in general, but for contact terms, at least you can always just analytically continue to the Euclidean time, so that you get a convergence. So for exchange is a bit of pushing our luck because you should be careful about the branch cuts that can rotate to Euclidean time, because these guys have branch cuts. So you have to see if you do not pick up some discontinuity and then you add like another layer of complication because you just cross a discontinuity. So modulo that, I think that it is possible to get convergent integrals. But of course, it becomes like exponentially complicated if you consider like higher point functions, which could be relevant for example. So for instance, recently, well, I mean, this is a this is going to be on a tangent. Yes, yeah, I think that it's complicated. Yeah. Mm-hmm.